Do you have a short attention span? When you want to listen to something, do you not know whether you want to hear comedy or drama or music? Well, we've got some of that here today. If you have a short attention span and can't decide what you want to listen to, this program's for you. My name's Matthew Bullis, and for the next hour, I'll be giving you some short pieces, nothing longer than 15 minutes. I'm going to start off with a series called The Word Detective. Now, there are 5 of these, and they're 3 minutes long, but I'm going to space them throughout the hour so that they don't get repetitious on you. Now, the file names, as I got them, have the words in them, but I'm not going to tell you what they are so that you can try to guess what he's talking about. This appears to be from 1959, and these 5 were the only episodes I could find. So these Word Detective shows are going to be interspersed throughout the hour, and you'll also hear a 1959 Henry Morgan show, which is kind of unusual, and we'll hear an episode of a show called The Unexpected, which is kind of a 15-minute version of The Whistler. If you've heard that show before, stories with a twist. And then we'll also hear the origins of superstition. It goes behind the story of the superstition of opening an umbrella in the house. So let's start off with the first of The Word Detective from about 1959.
In the era when the girl who was up to the minute was expected to display an hourglass figure, a buxom soprano christened Helen Porter Mitchell was the toast of New York and every capital in Europe. Today, in a way, she still is. You will see what I mean in the course of this edition of Word Detective, prepared as an educational service of this station in cooperation with the makers of Underwood Typewriters. In 1893, just 1 year before the debut of the very first Underwood typewriter, music-loving New Yorkers thronged to the Metropolitan Opera House for the American debut of the soprano who was already the darling of Europe. She came, she sang, she conquered. However, the particular incident which affects our dictionaries had to do not with the high C, but with low calories. As many soprano before and since, this noteworthy lady worried considerably about her weight. For many months during her tenure as prima donna of London's Covent Garden, she engaged the services of a masseuse, who came to our house in London every morning. But alas, it wasn't enough. She had to go on a strict diet, too. And herein lies her entrance into our dictionaries today. After one Covent Garden triumph, she went off to celebrate with a party of friends in the dining room of the Hotel Savoy. Exercising a great self-control, she shook her head at pheasant under glass and asked the waiter instead for a plain order of unbuttered toast. Somehow or other, the toast order was shunted off to an inexperienced assistant. When the prima donna received her snack, it was dry, thin, and hard. But instead of reacting to this with a temper tantrum, the soprano not only quietly ate the toast, but asked for another order of it, exactly the same. And now I suspect you know how this lady of the opera fits into our dictionaries, and in some case, our diets. I'll type the expression out for you right now on my Underwood typewriter, the only typewriter with the golden touch. It was Melba toast. After the turn of the century, prima donna Nellie Melba. The singer was born Helen Porter Mitchell in Australia back in the 60s, but when she made her opera debut in Brussels in 1887, she adopted the stage name Melba after the city of Melbourne in Australia. As any lover of rich desserts knows, Madame Nellie was responsible for the naming not only of the diet dish of Melba toast, but also a high-calorie concoction of vanilla ice cream, peaches, and claret sauce originated by the great French chef Escoffier, in short, Peach Melba. All of which means that Madame Melba was the only opera singer in history to be the toast of the town and also its dessert. Don't go away now. I'll be back in a moment.
So that was The Word Detective from about 1959, and I hope you enjoyed that. We'll have the other 4 throughout this hour. Now we move on to The Unexpected. This episode is from June 6th, 1948, and it's called Fool's Silver.
From Hollywood, Barry Sullivan in The Unexpected.
The Unexpected.
The Unexpected. Life is filled with the unexpected. Romantic, tragic, and mysterious endings to our most ordinary actions. Dreams come true, or dreams are shattered by sudden twists of fate in The Unexpected. But first, a word from your announcer. Barry Sullivan, famous motion picture and stage star in Fool Silver, a drama of the unexpected.
I shaded my eyes from the sun and looked hard to make sure it wasn't a mirage. Little spirals of dust obscured my view and the streets glistened in the bright sunlight. And the metropolis of Peerless, Nevada was real enough. Yet there was something wrong with what I saw. I felt it. I knew it. But I couldn't put my finger on it. And then it hit me. There wasn't anyone in sight. Not a soul on the streets or in the houses. The whole town was deserted and dead.
Hello!
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 Hello.
Anybody around here?
Around here?
Hello!
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 Only echoes answered me, rising and falling through the chinks in the ramshackle buildings like the wail of a lonesome coyote. My flesh began to crawl. This was a ghost town. Then I shrugged. I didn't have time to stand around seeing spirits. I had a heavy date with a roulette wheel in Vegas, and she was a jealous mistress. I picked up a water pail and lugged it toward the deserted saloon. I figured there might be enough watered whiskey left to keep my radiator perking for at least a few more miles. I took a couple of steps inside and stopped as if I'd been hit by a slug from a .45. Sitting at the long, splintered bar was the village ghost. And quite a vision she was, too. All decked out for haunting. Black high-heeled shoes, black stockings, black shorts and halter, and a mass of black hair. But her skin was creamy, and so was her voice.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, very good.
Looking for something?
Not now.
Then you won't mind leaving the same way you came.
Oh, I'd mind very much. I like the idea of this town, and I'd like to be haunted.
I said get out, mister.
I didn't hear you. Phantoms can't talk.
Suppose we pretend that I'm real.
Oh, no, I'm too young to have my illusions destroyed.
But I am real. If you pinch me, I scream.
Yeah?
And if I say get out, I mean it.
What's the hurry?
We don't like strangers.
We?
I mean the town doesn't like them. It resents the present. It prefers the past. You're too contemporary.
Well, maybe you know what you're talking about.
Oh, I do. Ghosts are very particular. They won't associate with just anyone.
And you?
I feel exactly the same way.
But
get out of here before something happens. The town and I might hasten your departure.
You're doing your best.
We have your interests at heart.
I should say there was something very odd going on around here.
I should say that you shouldn't get involved in it.
You could be right.
I am. Very right. So, it was nice to have met you. Sorry you can't stay, and good afternoon.
She waved a shiny little revolver in my direction, so I made a deep curtsy, backed out the swinging door, and headed up the trail, the empty water bucket banging against my knees. I'd gone about 100 yards past the town limits when I met the other ghost of Peerless, Nevada. He shot a parchment-skinned, white-headed face out from behind a mesquite bush and flagged me to a stop with a heavy gray beard.
Where are you heading, mister?
Why, nowhere in particular.
Well, that's good. I wouldn't like to think you was looking for me.
Oh, no, no. I often wander through abandoned towns in search of buried treasure.
Oh, so you did come to spy on me, huh? Come to learn my secret. Well, young fella, it won't work. Because I'm too smart for you.
Indeed?
Yeah, that's just like them. As soon as I made a strike, they're all ready to cash in on my claim. They laughed at me for 20 years. They wouldn't give me a nickel's worth of help. Now the vultures come swooping down.
As I stood there, the old boy suddenly motioned to me to wait and dropped from sight behind the bush like a gopher ducking a lawnmower. I didn't know what was going on in Peerless, but from the fear in the old codger's eyes, it must be mighty important to somebody. And then I got it. Silver. These mountains were full of it. Maybe Grandpa had found something. That was why the delicately garbed young lady in the saloon had been so anxious for me to leave. Yeah, but I had a notion I might enjoy sticking around, for more reasons than one.
Now then, young fella, you think you found me out, but you ain't. You don't know where the stuff is.
No, I don't.
And they won't believe I've struck it.
Won't they?
No, sir. They'll insist on proof, and you ain't got it. Unless...
Unless what?
Unless I give you this, then they'll know it's true.
Well, what is it?
Don't use your eyes, young fellow. What does that look like?
Well, it looks like silver.
That's just what it is. That's silver. It's mighty close to the pure stuff, too. What do you think of that?
My acquaintance with silver was limited to tea sets, dimes, baby spoons, and wedding presents. But the gray, shapeless lump which the old miner handed me looked like the real thing. So I dropped the sneer off my lips and asked a couple of questions. You say you found a whole lot of this?
Listen, young fella, I've been prospecting for over 60 years, and I ain't never seen a strike quite so rich.
Really?
But the only thing is, you see, I can't get much of it out by myself. Ain't got no money to buy this newfangled equipment. Now, if I was to take on a partner...
Well, how much do you need?
Oh, I need $200-$300. Now, if you was willing to switch over and work with me instead of agin me...
Why not?
Why, sure, you wasn't never cut out to be a spy anyway. You look too honest.
My face is my fortune.
Yes, sir. Now, here, you can help me in the mine, and we'll split 50-50.
That's a deal.
Yes, sir, young fellow. Old Hiram will make you a rich man. Well, come on. Don't just stand there. We got work to do.
As I followed Hiram through the hollow caves of the old mine, I did some fast mental gymnastics. I'd work with him, like he said. Only when the time came to sell the ore, I'd just collect a fee for myself. Then I'd stake out a legal claim to the old Peerless setup in my own name. Hiram could take his mule and go prospecting somewhere else. And I'd make a quick change from gentleman gambler to millionaire. I spent the whole next week underground, except for a short trip to Virginia City for new equipment. By day, I hacked at the rock wall till my hands were covered with calluses. By night, I loaded ore into the old mine cars to bring them to the surface. And day and night, I listened to Hiram jabber about the time when Peerless was a boomtown. Finally, I couldn't stand it any longer. I scrambled up to the surface and walked right into the unwilling arms of the lady in black. Only this time, she was all in white.
With Hiram.
So how would I know?
Look, mister, I'm tired of playing hide-and-seek. I'll take care of him.
Yeah, I bet you could.
He's an old man. He's harmless. He's lived here all his life. And neither you nor anybody else is going to bother him. I mean it.
Well, now, look, lady, I...
Grandfather's a little strange. He thinks he's found silver in this old mine. So he prospects around and digs a little. He's not hurting anybody. I come out every week and see that he's all right. Now, you just run back home and peddle your papers. I'll take care of Hiram.
Say, are you trying to tell me that the old guy is...
I told you, he's just a little odd.
Yeah, but the silver...
He didn't talk you into believing that, did he?
Oh, no. No, of course not. Only the stuff he digs up. What is it?
Lead ore. You know, they call it fool silver. Very low grade, practically worthless.
Lead ore.
Sure. Well, you can tell at a glance. But I let Hiram think it's silver. It keeps him happier that way. Of course, nobody would ever be foolish enough to believe that he really had made a strike. Now, would they?
No. Nobody could be that foolish. Nobody in the whole wide world.
You think the story is over, don't you? But wait. Fate takes a hand. Wait for the unexpected. For the surprising conclusion of Fool Silver, starring Barry Sullivan, a Hamilton Whitney production written by Robert Libbett and Frank Burt and directed by Frank K. Danzig.
Well, I'd played a long shot and lost. It had happened before, but I didn't like the way Hiram's granddaughter smirked at me as she drew the picture. So I bade her a sad farewell, jumped in my car, and sped into the setting sun. It took me several weeks to recover my self-respect and a few legitimate games of blackjack to restore my depleted finances. And then, except for the disappearing calluses on my hands, I was able to forget all about the adventure of the Peerless Silver Mine. But that was before I walked into Vegas' biggest hotel and saw Hiram sitting in the lobby. His hair was cut, his beard was trimmed, and a new diamond stick pin glistened in his tie.
Well, hello there, young fella. It's mighty nice to see you again.
Hiram, your granddaughter said that...
You thought I was crazy. Well, son, they all did, but I showed them. They're singing a different tune.
You mean the... Peerless did have silver, that it wasn't lead?
No, it was lead, all right. It was lead. But something else was in it, too. Something awful valuable. Oh, it's too bad you didn't stick it out. We'd have been partners. Government gave me an awful lot of money for that mine. You know, they said that lead was full of your...
You don't mean uranium, do you?
Yeah, that's it. Uranium.
Uranium.
Fool Silver starred Barry Sullivan. Listen soon for another of your favorite motion picture stars in a drama of The Unexpected. This program was transcribed in Hollywood.
Was The Unexpected from June 6th, 1948, a show called Fool's Silver. Okay, now, since it just happened to work out this way, we're going to do two of the word detectives right now. At the end of this one, he mentions the next one, so I'm going to play them in order so that it has a sequence. So here are two word detectives back to back.
2,000 years ago, in the crowded marketplace of an ancient North African city, the soldiers of Caesar Augustus sampled an exotic new delicacy from the East. This was the start of a chain of events which led to a treat on our tables and a word in our dictionaries. You'll hear more of that word on this edition of Word Detective, prepared as an educational service of this station in cooperation with the Underwood Corporation, for more than 60 years a leader in the field of typewriters and business machines. During the years when the sprawling Roman Empire fanned out to include most of North Africa, the Emperor Caesar Augustus signed an imperial edict which elevated a bustling Mediterranean seaport called Tanger to the status of a free city. We know this ancient Moorish metropolis as Tangier. In Caesar's time, it was a rich and cultured metropolis, an important stop on Arab trade routes from the Far East. The gate of the city, which led to the produce-packed stalls of the marketplace, gave local citizens access to a selection of the most exotic wares in the world. Spices from Ceylon, steel from Damascus, and at some point during Tangier's long history, nobody quite knows when, the squatting marketplace Moors added to their display a strange but delicious new fruit, delivered to the West African port by Arab caravans from the Malay archipelago half a world away. Within a short time after the fruit from the East was first put on sale in the marketplace, it was not only being served on West African tables, but also being cultivated in thick West African groves. When Caesar's foreign-based GIs visited the Tangier marketplace, this same cycle started all over again. They came, they saw, they tasted, and conquered by the experience, started their own flourishing fruit groves back home in Italy. Tucked into the toe of a Christmas stocking or adding color to the fruit centerpiece of a Thanksgiving table, we're apt to think of the fruit now as being all American. But when we add it to our shopping lists, we still refer to it as if we were ordering not from a neighborhood grocery store, but from the honey-scented stalls of a crowded North African marketplace. Maybe you know now the word which all this is leading up to. I'll type it out for you right now on my Underwood typewriter, the only typewriter with the golden touch. The word is tangerine, meaning literally a native of Tangier. This red-tinged member of the orange family, distinguished by its easily detached rind, actually originated somewhere in tropical Asia. We know it as a tangerine because 2,000 years ago, a group of African-based Roman soldiers went shopping in a Moorish market for souvenirs for the folks back home. On tomorrow's edition of Word Detective, we're off to the races in search of not just one word history, but a whole bundle of them. Now, don't go away. I'll be back in a moment. Could be you've never once been in the gleeful position of totaling up your winnings after betting a 30-1 long shot at the racetrack. Even so, the world of parimutuel machines and daily doubles has made you richer in one respect, your vocabulary. We'll be presenting a few examples on this edition of Word Detective, prepared as an educational service on this station in cooperation with the Underwood Corporation, for more than 60 years a leader in the field of typewriters and business machines. Aqueduct, Hylia, Pimlico, Santa Anita, and Belmont Park may be as remote from your world as the craters of the moon. But it would be quite unusual if you'd never used such expressions as neck-and-neck photo finish on the nose or dark horse, all of which had their origins in the environments of the racetrack. Each of these terms shows its racetrack background very clearly. But there's one very popular American expression which most people don't suspect came out of the straw-covered horse stalls behind the racetrack grandstands. We inherit this particular phrase from old-time American horse trainers who discovered that their high-strung thoroughbred charges grew considerably calmer if some other animal moved in with them as a regular stall mate. These emotionally stabilizing stable companions stayed with the thoroughbreds all through their training period and went along on track-to-track travels too, for it was particularly important for a horse to maintain a calm equilibrium on the day of a big race. And now, enter the villain. On more than one occasion, so racetrack legends say, unscrupulous gamblers sneaked into the stalls a few days before a race and made off with the animal, which was the steady companion of a horse ranked as a favorite. Without his long-time stall buddy as a calming influence, The horse would go to the post in a nervous twit and finish far out of the running, and the gamblers, with gloating smiles, would tote up their winnings. If I tell you now that one animal very often used to fill this role of calming companion was a goat, perhaps you can guess what expression it was that this old-time horse trainer's custom brought into our language. I'll type it out for you right now on my Underwood typewriter, the only typewriter with the golden touch. The expression was to get one's goat, which, according to one school of entomological thought, had its origin in the old-time horse trainer's habit of calming down a high-strung thoroughbred by giving him a goat as a roommate. To get a horse's goat was to make him nervous and unable to function at his best. And in our time, the expression has this same meaning: to bewilder, confuse, or baffle, to irritate, annoy, or vex. The only difference is that nowadays, when we use the expression getting his goat, we are talking not about a horse, but a human being. Don't go away now. I'll be back in a moment.
Okay, those were two word detectives. And now we move on to the Henry Morgan piece that I promised you. Now, he had a 15-minute show in the 1940s, the early 1940s, but this one was from 1959, and it's just him. There's no audience, nobody else in the studio, and honestly, it's not as funny as he usually is. But he reads from the paper, and he recites The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, and generally chats for about 15 minutes. So it's very rare, and so I thought that even if it wasn't as funny as he usually is, that you might still enjoy it. So here's Henry Morgan from 1959.
Good evening. I do that to kid the engineer. Good evening, anybody. Here's Morgan. See, I work from my house, so if I kid around, you don't know whether the equipment's bad or whatever. You know, that's pretty funny. Say, the paper's back, right? So this morning they delivered the World Telegram. No, what did they deliver? The Herald Tribune is what they'd bring her. Yeah, the Tribune. And they had a fascinating editorial about the strike. It said, and I quote inaccurately, because they threw the paper away. It's astounding. I don't know what your reaction was, but mine was, well, look at this piece of junk. They had only 18 days to think up an editorial, and they wrote how terrible it was to have no newspaper on account of you couldn't keep track of the births and deaths. That was their point of view. And this evening, they they bring the Journal American. The headline says, stocks highest in history, a piece of news I couldn't possibly have lived without. This is the paper for which I have been waiting. Here's the front page. Approximately one-third of the page one of the paper I couldn't live without is about the fact that presses are rolling again, with a picture of what is in newspaper dumb called a pretty girl reading the Journal American. That's the picture on page one. That's the news I have to wait for. My paper is back. And what's the news in the paper? That the paper is back. I thought that it would be a blessing just not to have to listen on television to the stories about the strike. The whole point in having the strike over is that they would shut up now. But no, now the paper wants to carry on about it. It's like when you get a haircut and you look in the mirror in the barber shop and you see yourself and yourself and yourself and yourself endlessly. Or like the little girl in the box of salt who used to carry a box of salt on which was a picture of a little girl carrying a box of salt. On which was a picture of a little girl carrying a box of salt. It's endless. We have here a newsprint tiger by the tail. At least they won't let you let go. What is the other big news? In Port Jervis, New Jersey, Port Jervis, New York, a citizen sent the mayor a dollar, which he thinks covers all the times he didn't put a dime in the meter. Page one. Then there's an editorial on page one. It's great to be back, it says. It's great to be back. Well, I have news for you, honey. I didn't miss you. Reading a paper is something like brushing your teeth. Your mother trained you early. And 9 cases out of 10, you could stop brushing your teeth and they'd fall out anyway. Well, what's the difference? In answer to, I think it's 2,000 requests, a little under perhaps, I'm going to read The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, from which I have eliminated 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 verses. Yes, I took 5 out. You will be astonished to know it does not change the meaning any. It's the same. It just happens that I read this so well that I couldn't stand the thought of your staying there any longer without having me do it. A little under 2,000. Well, the requests will probably come in after I'm finished, not to do it again. But I'm going to do it. This is a poetic-type poem, the style of which Mr. Poe borrowed from a poet who preceded him. It was a man named Albert Pike, who wrote a poem called, interestingly enough, Isidore, which originally appeared in the New York Mirror in 1843. And the style and the beat, the meter, which is the crux of Poe's Raven, was anticipated by this Mr. Pike. We do not know who he stole it from. As a matter of fact, I think I can read to it one stanza from Isidore by Albert Pike. Thou art lost to me forever. I have lost thee, Isidore. Thy head will never rest on my loyal bosom more. Thy tender eyes will never more gaze, fondly into mine, nor thy arm around me lovingly and trustingly entwined. Thou art lost to me forever, Isidore. It was mighty poor, but it gave Mr. Poe an idea. Poe wasn't too well either, you know. He was a sickly fellow. I think he's on the needle quite a part of the time. Well, Coleridge wasn't too well either. Who is? Let's think about it for a while and then dismiss it. None of us is too well. There's well. I've known people to be well, but not too well. I myself am far from being a bargain. Harvard has sent for my head. Once, upon a midnight, dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door, only this and nothing more." Distinctly, I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow. Sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, 'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. This it is, and nothing more. Presently, my soul grew stronger. Hesitating then, no longer, sir, said I, or madam. Truly, your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping at my chamber door that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here, I opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more. Open here, I flung the shutter. When, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he. Not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebon bird, beguiling my sad fancy into smiling by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore, though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou, I said, art no craven. Ghastly, grim and ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore, tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked upstarting, get thee back into the tempest of the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming. And the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul, from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor, shall be lifted nevermore. Pretty good. I may record that someday and play it to myself. Say, it did kill a lot of time. You see what happened? I was out today, counting traffic. And I want to tell you, this city is packed to the brim with imbeciles who drive their own cars into the middle of the town to see can they get out. Eventually, they get out and count the cost as nothing. Because they have nothing to do with their lives except to sit there and stare at somebody else's bumper. Of course, occasionally they give evidence of being minutely alive. They blow their horns. Egad, if I could but rise above the crowd and make loud, vulgar speeches to them. Starting with the premise, you don't need a car, you ass. All you do with it is drive into town and drive out of it. Why don't you take a bus? Let Steve Allen do the driving. Wait a minute, how's that ad go? That's right, leave the driving to him. Take a choo-choo. Walk. Don't go cluttering up my city with your noxious internal combustion engines. Sound pretty good, huh? So my advice to you, friends, is watch yourself at all times, because I am liable at almost any time to read the raven again. I like it. I like to hear what I do with it. And I think with constant practice, I can become completely overbearing. All I want from you is your time and attention. And incidentally, no one has yet told me whether it is correct to say, because why? Which I have again. Oh, I found another mistake in the same book. This is Bernstein's book, Watch Your Language. He said, quote and unquote, and you can't unquote anything. You can only end the quote. In each of us is a little streak of rottenness. Have you ever noticed? You like to pick on your betters. At least I do. Naturally, I first have to go through this terrible catharsis of admitting that I have betters. Once that is established, I no longer need the doctor. Having once established it, then I can pull my betters down. I'm like a born socialist. A socialist never wants to improve anybody's lot, really. He just wants to bring other people down to his level. This is the basic tenet of the entire communist form of government. Have you noticed? You think I'm kidding, don't you? Listen, kiddo, I say more things between lighting a cigarette and burning my fingers than you can shake a cat at. They don't happen, a lot of them, to make sense, but I say them just the same. For example, at this moment, I am not really saying anything. I am merely talking because the engineer thinks it's 8:15. That's his beeswax, right? He started me tonight at 8:02 and a half, I believe it was. After playing some imbecile music that was supposedly going to make you go out and buy a stereopticon set.
Driving tonight? This is Cowboy Boyle. Driving tonight?
This station has only one commercial.
Driving tonight? Buy Pritchard Motor Oil.
I've never caught the name of it yet. Well, that ought to hold him. I am still, strangely enough, up to this day, allowed to be here twice a week. Mondays and Fridays, 8 o'clock. And believe me, it is my pleasure. Morgan will be on the same corner in front of the cigar store again, by the grace of man. This is Monday, isn't it? Friday, then. Or Monday, whatever comes up next. Good night.
Henry Morgan from 1959. It was probably, I'm suspecting it was one of the monitor shows. Just a little 15-minute block of time that he had. Now we have time for another word detective.
You may live among completely modern furnishings in a 1959 model split-level house in the newest housing development in town. But your vocabulary, nonetheless, contains a touch of ancient Greek design. We'll be exploring this relationship between the creation of an Athenian architect over 2,000 years ago and our present-day speech on this edition of Word Detective, prepared as an educational service of this station in cooperation with the Underwood Corporation, leaders in the field of typewriters and business machines for more than 60 years. 2,300 years ago, among the favorite sightseeing spots of the thriving Greek city of Athens was the bustling local marketplace. One of the favorite sights there? An open colonnade at the north side of the market decorated with colorful panoramic scenes of great moments in Greek history. The paintings were big, impressive, and created by a famous Greek artist named Polygnotus. But the tourists, in truth, weren't nearly as interested in the pictures as in the Athenian citizens who strolled on a covered porch in front of them. Just as Hollywood sightseers flock to a restaurant where they have a chance of seeing Marilyn Monroe in person, so did these visitors hang about the porch on the north side of the Athens marketplace. Since Athens was at its peak quite a few years before the invention of motion pictures, the sightseers came not to ogle at movie stars, but at another sort of celebrity, philosophers. The professional thinking men in these filterless days of ancient Greece did most of their thinking in public places, in stores or temples or public baths or perhaps on street corners. Beginning in about 300 B.C., a goodly number of them made their headquarters every day on the open public porch where Polygnotus' illustrious battle paintings were displayed. They talked, they argued, and interested citizens were welcome to listen all they liked. In time, the influence of these thinkers spread far beyond Greece. But no matter where they lived, the followers of this philosophical school referred to themselves as if they had developed their ideas in the shelter of an Athenian marketplace colonnade. To people who seem to follow these philosophical ideas today, we give the same name. I'll type it out for you right now on my Underwood typewriter, the only typewriter with the golden touch. The word is Stoic, currently used to describe someone who seems not to be affected by passion or feeling, someone who's indifferent to either pleasure or pain. We get the word stoic from the school of ancient thinkers who established indifference to pleasure and pain as a philosophical goal. The ancient thinkers got their name because they hung out inside a painted porch in the Athens marketplace, such a porch in Greek being a stoa. On tap for next edition of Word Detective is the story of a murder case which greatly shocked the citizens of the 12th century and gave us a word. Don't go away now. I'll be back in a moment.
There's another Word Detective, and I don't know why he says back in a moment when he says tomorrow's Word Detective, so I don't know if it was part of something else, so I just don't know how that worked out or anything about the series. But these were the only 5 episodes I could find, and they just fit nicely in here. We'll have one more after this next piece. This next piece is The Origins of Superstition. This was a 15-minute show in 1935, and they delve into how superstitions came about, and they dramatize these. So I picked one here about the superstition of opening an umbrella in the house.
Superstition on the air. It is our pleasure to offer you another short story in the series designed to disclose the origins of superstition. This one deals with the belief that if you open an umbrella in the house, it's an omen of bad luck.
Scott, Nancy, it's raining cats and dogs. I can't go out in this weather. Why, I'll be soaked through before I get to the streetcar.
Well, why don't you use that old umbrella, Gordon? It'll help some.
Yeah, that's an idea. Where is it?
In the closet, dear.
Oh, here it is. Let's keep it still in good shape.
Don't, Gordon. Don't.
Don't what?
Oh, Gordon, you've opened that umbrella in the house. Now something awful is sure to happen.
Oh, don't be silly, darling. Well, we haven't used this umbrella in such a long time. I just opened it to see if it was still whole.
Oh, but dear, don't you know that it's bad luck to open an umbrella in a house?
Oh, bosh, Nancy. That's silly.
Oh, no, it isn't silly, Gordon. I know a number of people who've opened umbrellas in their houses and have had bad luck.
Imagine anybody having bad luck from opening an umbrella in the house. Why, that's superstition.
Oh, it is it? Well, let me tell you, Smarty, that centuries ago, in the city of Rome, a tragedy that actually occurred there was responsible for starting this very belief. But do you know how the umbrella was regarded by ancient peoples?
No, I didn't even know they had umbrellas in those ancient days.
They surely did. Why, they were used in China about 2,000 years before the Christ, as well as in India and other Oriental countries. You see, the word umbrella is based on the Latin umbra, which means shade. And literally, umbrella means a shade from the sun or fire. So umbrella or parasol was really the same thing in the early days.
Say, how do you know all this?
Well, when my brother got hurt in that automobile accident, right after he had opened an umbrella in the house, I looked this data up. Anyway, the sunshade was first used only by sultans and princes as an emblem of royalty. And with the Persian monarchs, it also symbolized the power of life and death. So the custom of using the umbrella was introduced to the Greeks and Romans from the Orient.
That's interesting. But what about that tragedy you spoke of that was responsible for starting this belief? How did that happen?
Well, in about the year 84 B.C., there lived in Rome Drusilla, the beautiful wife of a Roman officer, Julius by name. While Julius was serving with the Roman legions at the Asiatic front, Drusilla had become infatuated with Livius, a young Roman noble. As our story opens, Paulus, a dear friend of Julius, has just arrived at his tent from Rome with the news of Drusilla's infidelity and...
Ah, Paulus, you have returned at last. And how did you find things in Rome?
My business was successful, Julius, and they are pleased in Rome with the progress our army has made here.
Splendid. And now, what news have you of my wife, Drusilla? Is she well?
She is well, Julius.
Yes? And what else? Hath she sent me no message, Paulus?
She did ask me to convey to you her respects and homage.
Come, come, men, tell me more. Verily, thy tongue is an unwilling one today. Do you not realize that I have not seen my wife for almost 4 years? I hunger for news of her. Tell me, is she still as beautiful?
Yea, Julius. Beautiful as the siren Circe, and...
And what? Why do you halt so in your speech, Paulus? Why does your voice sound so bitter? Hath Drusilla offended you that you do not wish to speak of her?
Julius, you know how dearly I love thee. You are my most esteemed friend, and I cannot bear to have your name degraded.
My name degraded? What do you mean? Speak, Paulus.
Forgive me, Julius, but I must tell you the truth. Your wife, Drusilla, is to blame by her shameful intrigue with Livius, and all Rome knows of it.
Why, you dog! I'll kill you! You lie! You lie!
Nay, Julius... I speak the truth.
My wife would not be party to such infamy. I tell you, you lie.
But I did come upon them myself in closest embrace. I saw them with my own eyes.
You did see them, Paulus?
Yea, Julius. And I have told you this because I cannot bear to see you disgraced in the eyes of your countrymen.
I shall go to Rome at once and find out for myself if this accusation is true. If you have lied, Paulus, beware, for I shall kill you. And if what you have said is true, I shall kill them.
Mistress Drusilla, which robe will you wear this afternoon?
The violet one, Julia, for I must look my loveliest when Livius comes to me today. I must dazzle him.
Oh, mistress, you have done that already. He worships you. But do you never fear that Julius, your husband, will return unexpectedly someday and find you with Livius?
Nay, Julia, he is too busy with his wars. For verily, he doth love war more than he does me.
But, mistress, you know the passionate temper of your husband. He would kill you if he found out.
Yea, you are right. For Julius is violent when enraged. But Livius will protect me, Julia, for he adores me.
And why not? Verily, you are the most beautiful woman in all Rome.
Oh, Julia, thou hast the honeyed tongue of a flatterer. Oh, but 'tis hot today. The air seems stifling, does it not?
Yea, mistress. The air is indeed sultry. It seems to have turned so quite suddenly.
But make haste, Julia. The hour approaches for my meeting with Livius, and I want to be awaiting him in the garden when he comes. My robe, Julia.
Here, mistress. Oh, but be careful, for I do not wish to disarrange your hair. Ah, there, 'tis on. How ravishing you look.
Now, my umbrella, Julia.
Here, mistress.
Nay, stupid. Not this white one. Give me the violet one with the pearls embroidered at the edge of it.
Very well, mistress. Here it is.
Now then, Julia, stand away from me and hold up this mirror while I open my umbrella so that I may see how it becomes me.
Yea, mistress. Is this all right?
Ah, yes. This color is beautiful against my white skin. Is it not? Why, what is that, Julia?
I do not know, mistress.
Why, the floor is swaying beneath me.
Look out, mistress! The wall is cracking! It's falling!
Drusilla! Drusilla! Julia, where's your mistress?
Alas, Master Julius, you were too late. She lies buried beneath that crumbled wall. Oh, why have the gods done this terrible thing to her?
Yea, verily, I cannot understand it. What could she have done to have aroused their wrath?
Oh, she did nothing, Master. She did but open her umbrella, and the wall fell upon her.
Truly, Julia, by opening her umbrella in the house, she provoked the anger of the gods. 'Tis an omen.
And so, you see, Drusilla died as a result of opening her umbrella indoors. Now maybe you won't be so quick to say it's all superstition.
Oh, Nancy, you don't mean to tell me that you believe she was killed on account of opening an umbrella. Don't you see that whether she had done so or not, that earthquake would have occurred just the same? And if she hadn't been killed by that, well, her husband would have killed her anyway.
Well, then, if the wall hadn't crumbled and her husband had killed her, it still proves that by opening the umbrella, she would have had bad luck.
Oh, of all the absurd arguments. Don't you see that her husband wouldn't have killed her because she opened the umbrella indoors, but because his wife had been unfaithful to him? So you took up all this time with such nonsense. I've got to get started or I'll be late.
Well, do be careful, Gordon.
Oh, don't worry. Nothing's going to happen to me. Goodbye, dear.
Oh, what happened, Gordon?
What happened? I just tripped over that confounded umbrella and fell down a whole flight of stairs. That's what happened.
Oh, there. Now, didn't I tell you you'd have bad luck from opening that umbrella in the house?
Oh, go sit on a tack.
And so when Gordon fell down the stairs, Nancy was convinced beyond all doubt that by opening an umbrella in the house, you can't escape bad luck. Well, au revoir, and good luck to you.
Enjoyed that. That was The Origins of Superstition, and we're just about at an end here, so we have one more word detective.
117 years ago, An ambitious young man from Belgium set off for Paris in search of fame and fortune. He didn't do too well in the fortune department, but fared a bit better with regard to fame. His name is still a part of our language today. You'll hear exactly how and why on this edition of Word Detective, prepared as an educational service of the station in cooperation with the Underwood Corporation. For more than 60 years, a leader in the field of typewriters and business machines. He was the son of an inventor and set off for Paris in the year 1842, with ambitions of being an inventor himself. He worked out plans for a new invention in his father's workshop in Brussels. All he had to do now, he reasoned, was finish this invention, patent it, sell it to the French army, and voila, his fortune would be made. He finished his invention on schedule, had it patented, demonstrated it to General de Rumilly, aide-de-camp of King Louis-Philippe, and won the general's recommendation that it be adopted officially by the French army. Then came the problems. No military appropriations debate in Congress ever stirred up more controversy than did this suggestion of the general's that present army equipment be scrapped and replaced by that provided by the young inventor from Belgium. Military men ranted, editorial writers raved, and finally it was decided to arrange a special competition utilizing old equipment and new. When this test was over, the Committee of Impartial Judges issued a unanimous decision. The models of the Belgian inventor were much superior to any currently in use. And so the ambitious young inventor from Belgium signed his name to a contract giving him exclusive right to the manufacture of his invention for soldiers of the French army. Within a very few years, the invention was adopted by the armed forces of Great Britain, too, and then in the United States. Now, surrounded by such 20th century developments as radar, jet engines, and guided missiles, this invention, patented in Paris in 1846, is still on hand in army supply depots, and still, of course, in our dictionaries. I'll type the word out for you right now on my Underwood typewriter, the only typewriter with the golden touch. The invention of the young man from Brussels was the saxophone, named for its inventor, Adolf Sax. We think of the saxophone primarily as a dance band instrument, but its inventor conceived it originally as an exciting new tonal addition for military marching bands. Young Adolf Sax was handy with his hands and had a talent for invention, but unfortunately was not a very good businessman. He never did make the fortune he dreamed of, but there were other compensations. By the time Adolf Sax died in the 1890s, his invention was one of the most popular instruments of the musical scene, which it still is. Don't go away now. I'll be back in a moment.
Okay, that was the last of the Word Detectives that I could find. I hope you enjoyed all these things, a bunch of different things within the hour. Not to focus on anything too long, but let me know how you enjoyed it. This has been Matthew Bullis for this hour of Those Who Have a Short Attention Span.